From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Senate hearings open today on the nomination of the White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General. He faces tough questions on the torture of detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Cuba. We'll speak with journalist Mark Danner, author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. The defense continues closing arguments in the trial of civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. Her attorney, Michael Tiger, calls her courageous, brash, and feisty. She's accused of conspiring to assist a terrorist, her client, in a case being watched closely by lawyers around the country. She faces 45 years in prison.
Yesterday, when I got to court, the many people who came to hear the summation said, "Free Lynn Stewart," and also, "Free the Sixth Amendment, the right to counsel."
Then, as the scheduled January 30th date for elections in Iraq steadily approaches, we'll look at the mounting problems surrounding the vote.
Well, it's becoming increasingly clear that the Bush administration is stubbornly insisting on the date of the election, despite opinions to the contrary, not only by Iraqis among the people, but also by their own puppet representatives of the Iraqi puppet government.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. World leaders are meeting today in Indonesia for an international summit on the Asian tsunami. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan warned the world is in what he called a race against time to prevent another sharp rise in the death toll, which is now at more than 155,000. Annan warned that the number of fatalities could double due to the spread of disease and hunger if aid doesn't reach the survivors soon. While nearly $4 billion has been pledged worldwide, the UN has warned some of the promises might not be honored, as in previous disasters. More than a year ago, donors promised Iran more than $1 billion to assist with the Bam earthquake disaster. Iran complains only $17.5 million ever arrived. The leaders also proposed some money be given to the devastated countries as loans. Canada was the only donor to declare a unilateral moratorium on debt repayments. But Japan says it's willing to do so, and other countries indicate they support the idea. As the conference ended, the world leaders issued a declaration pledging to work together to help the shattered region recover and set up a tsunami warning system to ensure that the next time such a wave is generated, coastal communities will have time to flee to higher ground. An Australian man being held at Guantanamo has filed a lawsuit saying that in 2001, the U.S. transferred him to Egypt for 6 months, where he was electrocuted, beaten, and nearly drowned. His lawyers say they're trying to stop what they say are plans to send him to Egypt again. The Egyptian-born Mamdouh Habib, who was detained in Pakistan in October of 2001 as a suspected al-Qaeda trainer, alleges that while under Egyptian detention, he was hung by his arms from hooks, repeatedly shocked, nearly drowned, brutally beaten. He contends U.S. and international law prohibits sending him back. Habib's case is only the second to describe a secret practice called rendition, under which the CIA has sent suspected terrorists to be interrogated in countries where torture has been well documented. It's unclear which U.S. agency transferred Habib to Egypt. This is the first case to challenge the legality of the practice and could have implications for U.S. plans to send large numbers of Guantanamo detainees to Egypt, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and other countries with poor human rights records. Three since-released Guantanamo detainees said that when Hamdi first came back to Guantanamo, he was missing his fingernails, and medics didn't treat him, though he was bleeding from his nose, mouth, and ears. The Justice Department refused to comment on Habib's allegations, which were filed in November but made public only yesterday after a judge ruled that his petition contained no classified information. The department has not addressed the allegation that he was sent to Egypt. The authority under which renditions and other forcible transfers may be legally performed is reportedly summarized in a March 13, 2002 memo titled, "President's power as commander-in-chief to transfer captive terrorists to the control and custody of foreign nations." Knowledgeable U.S. officials said White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez participated in the memo's production. The administration has refused a congressional request to make it public, but it's referred to in an August 2002 Justice Department opinion, which Gonzalez asked for and helped draft, defining torture in a narrow way and concluding that the president could legally permit torture in fighting terrorism. The August memo is expected to figure prominently in today's confirmation hearing for Gonzalez, Bush's nominee to run the Justice Department as Attorney General. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. Meanwhile, the New England Journal of Medicine says U.S. Army doctors violated the Geneva Conventions by helping intelligence officers carry out abusive interrogations at military detention centers, perhaps participating in torture. According to the journal, medical personnel helped tailor interrogations to the physical and mental conditions of individual detainees at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. It says medical workers gave interrogators access to patient medical files and that psychiatrists and other physicians collaborated with interrogators and guards who in turn deprived detainees of sleep, restricted them to diets of bread and water, and exposed them to extreme heat and cold. The Washington Post reported in June that military interrogators at Guantanamo Bay had given access to the medical records of individual prisoners despite repeated objections from the Red Cross, a breach of patient confidentiality that ethicists said violated international medical standards. The article in the New England Journal of Medicine says interrogators in Iraq also had access to prisoners' medical files. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell boasted of helping to, quote, deliver Ohio for President Bush and said he was, quote, truly pleased to announce Bush had won Ohio even before all the state's votes had been counted in his own fundraising letter, which was written on his official letterhead. The letter, which was received by a Butler County resident December 31st, is a plea to support Blackwell's campaign for governor. The resident has asked to remain anonymous. In apparent disregard for his nonpartisan role as Ohio's chief election official, the Republican secretary and chair of Bush's Ohio reelection campaign slammed Senator Kerry as a disaster who would have reaped terrible and horrible results on both Ohio and the United States. Further, Blackwell's use of the word deliver finds striking resonance with another controversial fundraising letter sent by the CEO of the voting machine manufacturer Diebold, Walden O'Dell, in the summer of 2003, when he said he was, quote, committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year. A handful of House Democrats plan a long-shot effort to snarl President Bush's formal reelection by preventing Congress from counting Ohio's pivotal votes when lawmakers tally the electoral vote. In order to force Congress to act on a challenge to the election's legitimacy, the representatives would need one senator to endorse the complaint. Congressmember John Conyers had sent letters to senators seeking their support for his plan to object to the counting of Ohio's 20 electoral votes, which gave Bush his November victory over Kerry. The House Democrats' chief hope of finding a supportive senator today may be Senator Barbara Boxer. Her spokesperson said yesterday she's been asked to sign the complaint and, quote, she's considering it. Senator John Kerry wrote a letter to supporters yesterday saying he would not object to the certification of the vote. Should a senator and House member formally challenge a state's results, the two chambers must meet separately and consider the objection. That scenario would still ensure Bush's reelection because both bodies are controlled by Republicans. The LA Times is reporting a powerful business lobby is preparing a multi-million dollar campaign to aid the White House in its quest to win approval for conservative judges. The new effort, on behalf of some of the nation's biggest manufacturers, will increase the cost, visibility, and intensity of an already divisive confirmation process, one that has been dominated by social issues. The shift puts the business lobby on the same side as social conservatives. The man behind behind the campaign is former Michigan Governor John Engler, a longtime friend of President Bush who recently took the helm of the National Association of Manufacturers. Engler said in an interview Wednesday his organization would make confirmation of judicial nominees a top priority for the first time, providing money and a recently honed ability to stir grassroots action nationwide. The group plans to spend millions of dollars on the campaign, but the exact amount has not been decided. The Manufacturers Association represents such large blue-chip firms as General Motors, Boeing, and Caterpillar, as well as 10,000 small and medium-sized manufacturers. Analysts say the campaign will increase pressure on moderate senators, whose votes help block confirmation for 10 out of the 34 Bush nominees to federal appeals courts in the last 2 years. Several of those senators faced re-election in 2006 and are already facing threats from religious conservative leaders if they try to block conservative jurists. 10 former directors of WorldCom, the telecommunications company whose bankruptcy was the largest in history, have agreed to pay $18 million of their own money to settle a class action lawsuit by investors who lost hundreds of millions of dollars when the company collapsed in July 2002. The directors in the settlement neither admitted nor denied wrongdoing. They were directors of WorldCom from 1999 to 2002. As resistance attacks increase in Iraq, the U.S.-appointed government continues its struggle to organize the planned election on January 30th. In recent weeks, several senior Iraqi officials have indicated the vote may not happen, but the unelected prime minister, Iyad Alawi, said Wednesday he's committed to holding the elections on time. Meanwhile, President Bush tried to quash any momentum toward delaying the election by calling Iraq's interim president, Ghazi al-Yawar, who had expressed his own misgivings about the election on Tuesday, characterized the decision to hold them on time as a, quote, tough call. Alawi made his comments yesterday inside the heavily fortified Green Zone. He spoke 2 days after what some officials have described as an anguish phone call with President Bush, in which Alawi expressed worries that the Iraqi resistance was undermining the likelihood of a peaceful and legitimate vote. Analysts say the fact that Bush felt the need to discuss the matter with Iraq's leaders twice within 48 hours suggests a new level of concern in the White House that the movement for delay within the Iraqi cabinet must be cut off. The U.S. military announced Wednesday more than 35,000 U.S. troops will be deployed on the streets of Baghdad on January 30th, the date of the elections. We'll have more on this in just a few minutes. Marooned by Wire here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Juan, you have an interesting piece today in the New York Daily News called Latino Pride, Look Again. And it's about what's happening today, the beginning of the confirmation hearings for Alberto Gonzalez.
Yes, well, I raised the issue, obviously, that millions of Hispanic Americans around the country are going to be paying close attention to this hearing, because the reality is that Alberto Gonzalez would be the highest-ranking Latino ever to hold a cabinet position in the United States. And amazingly, he has gotten endorsements by major Latino organizations like the National Council of La Raza and the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, which is the oldest Latino civil rights group in the country. These groups don't normally endorse Bush appointees, but they note that he had an excellent record in Texas as a Houston lawyer, was very involved in the Latino community, is a supporter of affirmative action. But the reality is that the single most important question about Alberto Gonzalez as the person who would now be in charge of enforcing all of our nation's laws is, was he counseling the president to violate the law when it comes to the issue of treatment of prisoners from the war on terrorism? And that's going to be the central question that will be that Gonzalez will have to answer, his infamous memo of January 25th, 2002, saying that the war on terrorism had rendered the Geneva Conventions quaint and obsolete, and which basically has been seen as a major legal underpinning for the abuses and the tortures that occurred in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and other places where the U.S. forces are holding prisoners.
And Pacifica is doing gavel-to-gavel coverage. Any radio station can tune in for the day of the Alberto Gonzalez confirmation hearings. And later in the program, we'll be speaking with Mark Danner, who is author of the book Torture and Truth, and has an op-ed piece in today's New York Times that says, "We are all torturers now." There are protesters also today in Washington, D.C. and across the country who are challenging the certification of the U.S. election before we move on to the Iraqi election, and it's something you also have been looking at a good deal.
Yes, I've done several columns on this issue as well, and did one earlier this week. And I think one of the things that's been lost is not only the many concerns that people had about the original vote, but the even greater concerns they had about the recount that occurred just before Christmas, and that, as has been pointed out by the National Voting Rights Institute in a lawsuit that they have now before the U.S. District Court in Ohio, the many, many counties of the 88 counties in Ohio did not even follow the law. The Ohio law as to how to conduct a recount. They were supposed to choose, randomly select 3% of the vote from precincts representing 3% of the vote, do a hand recount of those precincts, and if there were discrepancies between the hand recount and the actual machine count, they were then to do a hand recount of the entire county. Many, many of the counties did not do that. They arbitrarily chose certain counties, certain precincts that they thought would produce a good result. They were several of them were in direct communication with Secretary of State Blackwell when the Green Party challenged them. So they did not even abide by the law of the recount, and that's why the National Voting Rights Institute, joined by the Kerry campaign, are now calling for a new recount of the Ohio vote. And that's part of the reason why Congressman Connors and several other congressmen are saying, wait a second, this certification cannot go forward until that recount is completed.
And it's quite something. This story we read in the headlines about Ohio's Republican Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, who puts out a letter on Secretary of State stationery, Ohio government stationery, saying he's truly pleased to announce Bush won Ohio. The letter going out announcing his own hope to run for governor of Ohio and talking about delivering the votes to Bush.
Well, it's amazing because I don't know what Ohio law is on this, but under New York state law, you cannot use state stationery to put out, one, a political appeal, fundraising appeal, and obviously a politically partisan attack like he had on John Kerry and supporting George Bush. So in New York, that would be illegal. I don't know what the Ohio laws are, but it is amazing that you're using a government stationery as a public official for a political campaign.
Well, we will put that letter on our website, but right now, for a quick look before we go to Lynn Stewart, who is in the midst of a trial for her who's being tried, really one of the major acts of John Ashcroft going after a lawyer. We're going to also speak with Mark Danner, but we're going to go to a break and then talk quickly about what's happening right now in Iraq with the election date coming closer. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Our TV program is closed caption for the deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the situation in Iraq. Jordan is hosting a meeting of Iraq's neighbors today to rally support for Iraqi elections on the scheduled date of January 30th. Representatives from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Syria are expected to attend. Iran's foreign minister is boycotting the meeting in protest of comments by Jordan's King Abdullah, who has accused Tehran of meddling in Iraq and trying to create a Shia sphere of influence in the region. Representatives from Iraq, Egypt, Bahrain, and the UN are also expected. Jordanian Foreign Minister Hani Mulki said Amman wants all the nations present to issue a, quote, clear message to Iraqis that they should vote in the poll. But as the date for elections in Iraq steadily approaches, chances that the vote will actually take place on January 30th seem to be diminishing.
Earlier this week, Adnan Pachichi, a senior Sunni politician, reiterated his call for a postponement of the elections in an article in the Washington Post. Iraqi Defense Minister Hazem al-Shalan also mentioned the possibility of postponing the elections and has traveled to Cairo to formally request the Egyptian government encourage Iraqi Sunnis to participate in the elections. The Iraqi president, Ghazi al-Yawar, has also raised strong doubts about the vote, whether it can be held, and called on the UN to step in, saying the UN, quote, should really step in for their responsibilities and obligations by saying whether the election is possible or not. And the unelected prime minister, Iyad Alawi, called President Bush this week to discuss problems with the vote. Alawi is a staunch advocate for holding the vote on January 30th, but New York Times reports many in Washington interpreted the call, quote, as an effort to test the waters and to determine if Mr. Bush would brook a delay. We're joined by Asad Abu Khalil, who's a professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus and author of several books on the Middle East. His latest is The Battle for Saudi Arabia, Royalty, Fundamentalism, and Global Power. Runs the new blog called angryarab.blogspot.com. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Your response to these latest developments, do you think the vote will be held on January 30th, what will happen?
Well, I mean, the question is, some vote may be held because there are two influential Iraqis who are insisting against postponing the election. One of them is Grand Ayatollah Sistani, and the other one is George W. Bush. Because it has become obvious now that the puppet prime minister of Iraq, Alawi, has placed a friend call to the White House in which he was indicating his concern not only for whether the Sunnis will participate, but about his losing fortunes. I mean, I think, and the New York Times did indicate that he's very concerned about his utter unpopularity, and the White House wants so bad to keep him in that position. And you also see in Iraq so many disunited voices within the puppet government itself and elsewhere. And we saw yesterday the so-called president, puppet president of Iraq, was also expressing strong reservation and criticism against the United States doing what it did in Fallujah, which is basically destroying the city. And Iraqi newspapers are also indicating that there is not enough information about this election. According to Iyad Alawi's own newspaper, As-Sabah, some 7% of Iraqis really know the agendas and programs of the various electoral lists. And worse than that, many of the electoral lists that they are supposedly be voting on do not carry the names of the candidate for security reasons. So you're supposed to vote for a list. The names on the list are only known to the leaders of the party for security reasons. So we are seeing a fragmentation of the country along the sectarian lines of Sunnis and Shiites, Kurdish and Arabs. And we see very clear evidence that the country of Iraq is going to be very difficult to patch back together after George W. Bush's style of liberation.
But one question about this whole issue of the sectarian differences. On the Shiite majority, it's been portrayed here in the U.S. press largely as supportive of these elections as opposed to the Sunnis. Any thoughts on that, whether this the question of supporting or opposing the elections is basically one of the normal sectarian divisions within Iraq?
Well, I mean, there's so many misconceptions in the American coverage about what's going on. Let's take also the question about the Shiites being led by Ayatollah Sistani, who we are told is a secular leader. I mean, who is far from it. This is the Grand Ayatollah who wants to have a marriage between clerics and the government, that he wants to run the government. And in fact, you see his picture on the posters of the main list that he has officially endorsed. Second, there are important factions within the Shiite community, people who are loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, who have not gone away, who are also interested in trying to have Sunnis become part of the political process. The country is disunited within communities and also outside of the communities.
Also, what about this whole issue of the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis abroad, especially in the United States, who will be participating in the vote? And it sounds like the U.S. government will be doing everything possible to mobilize the U.S.-Iraqi vote.
This is, I think, where one should keep the eye for the potential fraud that is going to be managed by the Bush administration. Don't be surprised if you find a lot of the red states voting for the Iraqi election in order to arrange for the perpetuation of power by the puppet prime minister and his cronies. I think the United States is in a position to, it was the government that was pushing for the participation of the so-called Iraqis abroad because they feel maybe that's where we will find support for these unpopular crooks and unsavory characters, many of which were henchmen for Saddam, who are now America's client inside the country. In fact, in Jordan, the country you mentioned where there is this meeting that's being held, which is at the urging of the United States, I mean, it failed before it began. The Iranians have boycotted it and criticized the Jordanian government. The Jordanians have been critical of the meeting, and in fact, there was a debate in the Jordanian parliament yesterday calling on the government to desist from plastering the street of Amman with posters that are pro-elections, because they say that this is part of the American attempt to have many of these people vote in a way that is convenient to the American public. I should also mention that what is not reported in the American press is an important interview in a Lebanese newspaper today with the Prime Minister of Jordan, in which he admitted that there are plans in Jordan in place to prepare for the eventual occurrence of a bloody civil war inside Iraq.
Do you think they'll be using Diebold machines in voting?
I'm sorry?
Do you think they'll be using Diebold machines?
I have no doubt that the Jordanian government, which has extensive experience, corruption, brutality, as well as fraud, will do all their powers to facilitate the plan of Bush's administration to garner some support for the puppet prime minister. Let us not forget that the puppet prime minister, Alawi, had also a loyalty to the Jordanian intelligence service, which was also behind the founding of his unpopular organization.
I actually meant Diebold voting machines in Iraq on January 30th, if the vote goes forward.
I am not sure how the fraud is going to take place, but I think that there is already signs of an imbalance in voting, and it is going to reinforce the differences between Sunnis and Shias.
Last question. It has to do with the bombing in Mosul of December 21st and the news coming out now that it was a Saudi medical student whose father, though wouldn't confirm this, said his son did go to Iraq to fight and died. Your response?
My response to this is I am utterly amazed about two things that come out about the question of neighboring countries. One of them is that you have the Jordanians, the Jordanian king, when he's in Washington, he would never dare say these things in Arabic because he always denies in Arabic what he says in English, coming here and talking about Iran interference, which leaves one with the impression that the neighboring countries of Iraq are not supposed to intervene, but the country that is 10,000 miles away from Iraq, the United States, has every right to intervene. The second thing about that is if one looks at American statements about the intervention by Syria and by Iran, nobody hears a word about the Saudis. And yet if you look at Saudi websites and the Saudi press, they always carry articles about many fanatical Saudi extremists, people loyal to bin Laden and others, are infiltrating into Iraq. And the websites of many of these groups are full with statements and interviews that are part of the support, propaganda support for the insurgency. And we don't hear anything about that. It seems that the Bush administration is very ginger in dealing with the Saudi House of royal family, which is typical in American foreign policy, and yet they are very forthcoming and outspoken about Syria and Iran.
And it's very interesting to look at the U.S. press, how little attention has been paid to this information, and if the person who had blown up the U.S. soldiers in Mosul was Iranian or Syrian, I think we would probably know their names and their family stories.
Let us not forget that.
Certainly their country of origin.
Let us not forget that 26 Syrian clerics in Saudi Arabia issued a statement that was even mentioned in the Saudi press in which they called on Saudis to go to Iraq and engage in holy war.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Asad Abu Khalil. He runs a blog called angryarab.blogspot.com. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to the trial of Lynn Stewart, closing arguments continue today in her trial. Civil rights attorney in a New York courthouse just blocks from our firehouse studio. We spent yesterday afternoon watching Michael Tiger beginning his arguments. Lynn Stewart's accused of being part of an international conspiracy to provide support to terrorists, specifically aiding a convicted terrorist, her client. She's accused of conspiring to defraud the United States and making false statements. She's being tried with her two co-defendants, the Arabic translator, Mohammed Yusri, and a Staten Island resident, postal clerk, Ahmed Abdel Satter. But the focus of the trial centers on a man already in jail, the Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, who also is known as the Blind Sheikh. He's serving a life sentence on terror-related charges. While he's still in jail, the government is accusing Lynn Stewart, the Sheikh's attorney, as well as her two co-defendants, of conspiring to sneak messages into the Sheikh and then to sneak his words out. Most notably, the government claims the three conspired to release a press release announcing that the Sheikh no longer supported a ceasefire in 2000 between the militant Islamic group and the Egyptian government.
The case is being closely watched by defense attorneys around the country who fear the government aims to limit their freedom to fight for unpopular clients. The six-month trial featured very few witnesses as the government's case was based primarily on transcripts from more than 85,000 secretly recorded audio and video clips of meetings between Stewart and her client, as well as the home phone of Ahmed Abdel Satter. If convicted, Stewart faces up to 45 years in prison. She She's being defended by the acclaimed attorney Michael Tiger, who's best known for representing Terry Nichols during the Oklahoma City bombing case.
That's right. Michael Tiger was a lawyer in the 69 Chicago 7 trial. He won a life sentence instead of a death sentence in Terry Nichols' case. Of course, Timothy McVeigh was given the death sentence. The closing arguments continue today. Lynn Stewart will be headed to the trial right after this program. Your response so far, Lynn Stewart, your lawyer calls you courageous, brash, and feisty. The thousands of tape recordings that have been made, did this number surprise you? What is it now, 8,500?
No, 85,000.
85,000.
They were mainly made of Mr. Sitar's telephone and then laterly Mr. Usry's telephone. I was never tapped. I was never a target until John Ashcroft decided to make me the centerpiece of this particular prosecution. But it is notable that with all these calls and supposedly a conspiracy that we question, I'm not on any of those calls. I'm just not there. It's just not, my name isn't mentioned. I'm never, there's no reference to the female lawyer who's going to help us out with this or anything else. So the absence of evidence is also supposed to count for something, I think. So we're winding down in answer to the first question, I guess. The 6-month trial, I was on the witness stand for 3 weeks, which Michael will be commenting on today. And at least at this point, it will be in the hands of the jury. And as I've said to you before, Amy, I have great faith in the jury system. I'm not saying it works perfectly because, of course, it brings inherently all the prejudices of the society.
The prosecutors have raised a lot of questions and in the summary arguments as well about why you went and visited the sheikh in prison. I mean, they say it's a life sentence, no chance of getting out, raise questions, and of course, focusing on that 2000 press release that you were trying to communicate with his supporters in Egypt when the government was trying to cut off all communication to say, end the ceasefire.
Right. Well, of course, we do. As Michael said yesterday, we lawyers who do this kind of pro bono work for people who are despised or thought little of, we wear that as a badge of honor. And it wasn't me alone, of course. That's one of the big points of our cases. It was me. It was Ramsey Clark, Abdin Jabara. We all were doing this. The tape show, we all dealt with him in pretty much the same way. So it was mainly, it's mainly done because you want to keep pressure on the government so the conditions don't worsen. You want to bring up a lawsuit if the time is right to make a lawsuit. You can't let the government dictate how you practice law. Lawyers being autonomous is really, to some degree, the backbone of the entire legal system when it does work well, and lawyers making decisions based on the rules of ethics. So those things are all in the case. But I always like to say there's absolutely no proof that I'm linked to any terrorist conspiracy, and that they have to prove. And the second thing is everything I did, Ramsey Clark did, Abdin Jabara did. So I'm sure the jury is going to say, why weren't they arrested? Why aren't they part of this?
And why do you think that Ashcroft decided to target you specifically and to go after you in this way that even that most defense lawyers, no matter what their political persuasion, cannot believe happened?
Yeah, I think that, well, Ashcroft, as we know, has a certain viewpoint, and a certain viewpoint towards women, I think, is pretty clear also. So my friends do say, if you don't think this has to do with your being a woman, you're crazy. But I also think one of the things that they said in their summation was something like, if it's a revolution, Stewart's for it. She'll back any revolution. Like, I'm some wingnut, left-wing wingnut out there, you know, espousing soapbox violence for everything. They sort of wanted to commingle my personal politics with my work as a lawyer, which really are very, very separate. I hardly am a fundamentalist, but I think Ashcroft saw me as an easy target. I hope he now knows that he was wrong.
They also accuse you of covering up political conversations that your translator was having with Sheikh Abdurrahman, putting out words that might cover as they were having a conversation, since you weren't supposed to have political conversations but only legal conversations. Now, they knew this because they were recording your conversations.
Exactly. You know, when you visit someone in a jail, when the guards seemed to get too interested, we now realize they were so interested because the FBI was in the next room taping all of this. So it was a different scenario. But we couldn't understand why they were leaning in, why they would turn around and look at us. And so we said, you know, let's deal with this. I know that I have the right as a lawyer to protect my client's confidences, whatever they may be. If he says, you know, I'm having trouble with my teenage son, I'd like you to tell my wife, do this and that. He has a right to have confidence. And saying that to me, confidence in me and also a confidence. So when we whisper, we lawyers, when we go talk in somebody's ear, whatever way we do it, even Patrick Fitzgerald, who was their first witness, the government's, for the sine qua non prosecutor, said, you know, there are things that are secret and lawyers are bound to protect them. That's all we were doing. There's no big secret. When they recorded it, they could see that we were equally protected. Conversations that were totally innocuous to those which might have had some political content.
So, in other words, they are prosecuting you for being too good at preventing them from being able to listen in on what should be confidential conversations with your client.
Exactly. When they, as Michael Tiger likes to say, they were not supposed to be listening in, but you're wrong for preventing them from listening to what they're not supposed to listen to. It's a little convoluted, but it sort of is the heel mark of the entire case.
Well, we will continue to follow this case. Again, closing arguments continue today in New York at 40 Foley Square. It is open to the public. We went down yesterday afternoon to hear the beginning of these closing arguments, and we will continue to follow your case. Lynn Stewart, the attorney who faces 45 years in prison. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we will be joined by Mark Danner. He has an op-ed piece today in the New York Times on Alberto Gonzalez. It's called We Are All Torturers Now. He's author of the book Truth and Torture. Stay with us. Peace Attack, Sonic Youth, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today, the confirmation hearings for Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General begin. Pacifica will be covering them throughout the day. We'll be bringing you excerpts tomorrow on Democracy Now! In the New York Times today, an op-ed piece by Mark Danner called We Are All Torturers Now. Mark Danner writes for The New Yorker magazine, and he's just written a new book called Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. But in today's op-ed piece, he starts, at least since Watergate, Americans have come to take for granted a certain storyline of scandal in which revelation is followed by investigation, adjudication, and expiation. Together, Congress and the courts investigate high-level wrongdoing and place it in a carefully constructed narrative in which crimes are charted, malfeasance is explicated, and punishment is apportioned as the final step in the journey back to order. order, justice, and propriety. When Alberto Gonzalez takes his seat before the Senate Judiciary Committee today for hearings to confirm whether he will become Attorney General of the United States, Americans will bid farewell to that comforting storyline. The senators are likely to give full legitimacy to a path that the Bush administration sent the country on more than 3 years ago, a path that's transformed the United States from a country that condemned torture and forbade its use to one that practices torture routinely. Through a process of redefinition largely overseen by Mr. Gonzalez himself, a practice that was once a clear and abhorrent violation of the law has become, in effect, the law of the land. Mark Danner joins us in our studio. Juan?
Well, let's begin in terms of what are some of the key acts of Alberto Gonzalez to promote what the current situation of this sort of rampant pattern of torture by American troops of prisoners?
Well, Mr. Gonzalez, as White House counsel, was essentially point man at the top of the administration in carrying out their determination to change how the United States deals with prisoners. Early on, right after 9/11, it was recognized within the administration that we have to take the gloves off, which is the phrase that Kofor Black, the counterinsurgency official in the CIA, used. And Mr. Gonzalez pushed through a couple of very important changes. One was the idea that we will withhold, the United States for the first time, will withhold Geneva Convention protection from prisoners in Afghanistan. And that's not only al-Qaeda prisoners, but Taliban as well. The second change was a redefinition of torture. Torture, of course, as your listeners know, is illegal. It's illegal under American domestic law. It's illegal under the Torture Convention, the international agreement that the United States is party to. In this administration, torture was essentially redefined in very, very narrow terms. Torture has to be pain. Under this memorandum that the Justice Department drafted at Mr. Gonzalez's instigation, torture has to be the infliction of pain equivalent to major organ failure or death. So the level that pain must exceed in order to constitute torture under the law, according to this administration, is a very, very, very high one. And if you use that standard, then things that most people will recognize as torture, waterboarding, for example, in which the prisoner's submerged and made to think he's drowning or brought to the point of drowning, that suddenly becomes, poof, like magic, not torture. So a key part of what Mr. Gonzalez supervised was taking procedures that everyone in the world recognized as torture and saying, ha, they're not torture. These are interrogation techniques, but they do not rise to the level of illegality. And that it will be, I think, what he will be remembered for as counsel to the president.
Well, interestingly, in terms of the leaks that have come out of the administration debate over this issue, it's become clear that Secretary Powell, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that most of the central the central command of the military opposed these formulations of Gonzalez, and Secretary Powell actually gave a stinging memo rebuking them and challenging them,
yeah.
And yet Powell's on a way out, and Gonzalez is rising up.
That's right. That's right. One of the fascinating things about this story is the fight within the administration. And you see it. You see it in the collection of documents in this book. You see that the State Department and also many military officials, many military officers, were the ones who really fought this redefinition. Secretary Powell, I think partly because of his background as a military officer, obviously, believed that this kind of redefinition would really end up hurting terribly, not only America's place in the world, but American troops, because military commanders tend to look at these sorts of policies very clearly as something that will affect their people, their troops. The Geneva Convention is there not simply to protect prisoners Americans take, but Americans when they become prisoners. And military officers have this kind of thinking drummed into them. They also think that the use of torture is going to affect good order and discipline. The troops who do this to prisoners are in the end not going to be very good soldiers, not effective soldiers. And you see in these memos, and now we have them, you know, they're published in this book, they're available, you see this argument within the American government about whether or not to do this. And Powell and many in the military are on the side of saying, look, we can't go forward along this road. Much of what they predicted would happen has, in fact, come to pass.
You have this unprecedented letter that has been sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee of a dozen top generals, brigadier generals retired, mm-hmm. including the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Shalai Kashvili. Yesterday
right.
we had on James Cullen, retired brigadier general.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked him, do you think that Alberto Gonzalez endangered the troops? And this is a brigadier general. And he said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he also raised the issue of people like New York Senator Charles Schumer and others saying that Bush has a right to appoint his cabinet, his attorney general, and his fear that the Democrats will not seriously question, and that the questions are coming from outside, from generals, from brigadier generals, from military lawyers.
That's right. I think there is a general fear. The Democrats, like Senator Schumer of New York, will assume, you know what, the Republicans have the vote, this guy is going to get through, so why do we fight him, particularly on an issue that the general perception is most Americans don't necessarily care about. I mean, this is thought politically to be essentially defending terrorists rather than defending the human rights of people. So on the other hand, I think over the last several days, there's been a palpable change of attitude in Washington. I think people have suddenly realized that there's going to be a fight on this issue. And you see it in a statement yesterday by President Bush supporting his nominee, affirming that he stands firmly behind him. I think they've had more opposition than they expected. And critical are the dozen military officers, admirals and generals that you mentioned, who include not only former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Shalai Kashvili, but also General Joseph P. Hoar, who was the successor of General Schwarzkopf as commander of CENTCOM. You know, he ran the Middle East Command, very distinguished officer, and has been very vocal in his arguments against what Gonzalez did, basically pointed out, as I quote in that New York Times op-ed, that, you know, the French in Algeria used torture in very widespread, systematic fashion to fight an insurgency that's very like what the United States is fighting in Iraq. And as he said, it led to immediate successes in the Battle of Algiers, but it eventually dishonored the army and lost them the war. And I think this is a very useful point, that we're talking here not simply about a human rights issue, although it is primarily a human rights issue, but also in the end a practical issue about whether you can win a war when you let your army torture, when you let your people slip below the standards of human rights that they are claiming. They are claiming to be in Iraq and to be in other parts of the world to promote. And whether or not you believe that, the key point here is that by using this technique, you undermine your own position.
Explain Alberto Gonzalez's direct involvement. The Times yesterday, mm-hmm. the front page piece, that he directly intervened in the August 2002 memo. People hear this memo, that memo. What is Gonzalez's responsibility here?
It's a very good question. There are two very clear things he did. One was he spearheaded the effort to deny Geneva Convention protections to prisoners that the United States took in Afghanistan, point one. And clearly that is kind of the seed, you know, the bad seed at the beginning of a lot of these abuses. The second thing he did was solicit from the Department of Justice, from their Office of Legal Counsel, which is kind of their think tank, an opinion on torture. An opinion that essentially torture actually is a very narrow phenomenon, intense pain, severe pain, the level of debilitation or death or organ failure, and things that fall below that level of pain, they're not torture. They may be abuses, but they are essentially allowed. They're legal. Apparently what we learned in the Times yesterday was that Alberto Gonzalez's White House counsel essentially went to the Justice Department. He went beyond below, I guess you would say, Attorney General Ashcroft and the Deputy Attorney General, and asked directly the people in these this think tank to give him a memo that it was implied very strongly in the Times piece. He essentially led them on about what he wanted. In the questions he asked, it was very clear that he wanted this result, and they gave him the result. And that result, which was all of these things that you want to do to prisoners, though they look like torture, sound like torture, feel like torture, are not torture under the law, that was spread throughout the government and, in the end, dominated how the military has treated prisoners.
And one of the prime authors of that memo was John Yoo, wasn't he? Who's now a frequent commentator on the Lair News Hour.
That's right. He's a colleague of mine when I teach at Berkeley. Yes, he's at the University of California Law School.
But in terms of the now, apparently, in the AP release of the prepared statement that Gonzalez is going to make today, Gonzalez says that he tries to distinguish between what his role was as White House counsel, where he was basically giving advice to the president, and what he understands his role will be as attorney general, where he has to stand for the law and justice for all of the American people. Now, that sounds to me like a kind of a strange dichotomy that he's making there between his role as consigliere and his role as a top law enforcer.
It's a very common distinction that's made. When you become attorney general, you take an oath to protect the Constitution and the laws of the United States. As White House counsel, you're essentially the president's lawyer. So supposedly they're different roles. My view of this is really rather simple, which is that in his position in the White House, rather than helping the president do what he needed to do while following the law, he gave him advice that let him circumvent the law. And my colleague Anthony Lewis, in a piece a while back in the New York Review of Books, compared this to reading these memos to reading the documents of a mafia lawyer whose job it is to help the Don stay out of jail. You know, this is how we can reinterpret these laws so that, in effect, you're breaking them, but we can claim that you're not. And, you know, you see this. I was looking at, on the way down here at this editorial in the Wall Street Journal today, their lead editorial, which is entitled Torture Showdown. And you see them actually, they say, as for Al-Qaeda, let us describe the most coercive interrogation technique that was ever actually authorized. It's called waterboarding, and it involves strapping a detainee down, wrapping his face in a wet towel and dripping water on it to produce the sensation of drowning. Is that torture? It is pushing the boundary of tolerable behavior, but we are told it is also used to train U.S. pilots in case they are shot down and captured. They're trying to argue, essentially, that because these procedures are used to train Americans and how they will be tortured, that, in fact, it's not torture, which is a quite ridiculous argument. Waterboarding, to go back to Algeria, was one of the favorite techniques of the French when they tortured in Algeria in the late 50s. It is called, in Latin America, El Submarino. It is the main torture technique used in Uruguay and Argentina. There's just no question that this is torture. You're essentially convincing somebody that you're drowning him. But we have now the major, a major national newspaper essentially arguing in here, very close to the terms in which the White House did, that actually this may be abusive, this may be pushing the line, but it's not torture. And I think this is a less than credible line of argument, and it's also corrupting all of us, I believe. You know, they make a second argument here, which is that, the idea behind these techniques of interrogation is to prevent another attack. And if there's another terrorist attack on the United States, that may lead to a crackdown that'll really remove all civil liberties. So, in fact, this is a way to support civil liberties. People used to use this argument about the Salvadoran War, for example, by saying, there are these massacres and all the rest of them, but think if the communists take over. That will be a human rights catastrophe. In other words, it's always an abuse of human rights that's used to prevent a larger one. And I feel as if that sort of reasoning is a snare and a delusion and a trap into which this country in its public life, in its civic life, cannot fall. Because in the end, and this is why the title of that op-ed was "We Are All Torturers Now," it corrupts all of us.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Mark Danner is author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He has written an op-ed piece in the New York Times today called We Are All Torturers Now. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Mike Burke, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can sign up for our Daily Digest email list. We'll also have posted today the letter of Kenneth Blackwell, the Ohio Secretary of State, the letter he wrote on state stationery announcing he is running for governor and asking for funds, also hailing the fact that President Bush won and he helped deliver the vote. Again, our website is democracynow.org. Hope to see people on Saturday at the Community Church in Manhattan with journalist Alan Nairn and Achenese refugees talking about the situation in Indonesia, calling for aid not to go to the Indonesian military, but to Indonesian human rights groups to spread and deliver the aid. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.